This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Do you ever see a successful woman on your feed or in a magazine and think, wow, it must be nice to have it so easy? Well, think again. Behind that glossy cover or smiling face is a ton of hard work, countless failures, and endless learning experiences. I'm Rebecca Minkoff, and I'm here to tell you that success isn't a walk in the park. It takes grit, resilience, and a willingness to take risks. That's why I created Superwoman, a podcast that peels back the varnish and gets into the nitty-gritty of what it takes to make it as a woman in today's world. From luminaries and game changers to women you've never heard of but should, this podcast is here to inspire you to take your next leap, no matter how daunting it may seem. We'll explore the sacrifices these women have made, the highs and lows they've experienced, and the lessons they've learned along the way. So if you're ready to be inspired and learn from some of the most successful women out there, join me on Superwomen. Together, we'll uncover the stories behind the successes and prove that with hard work, determination, and a little bit of luck, anything is possible. Hey everyone, you're listening to Superwomen. Today's guest is the indomitable Eve Barlow. I met Eve over, as a lot of people do, Instagram after October 7th, when I saw what she was posting and was fueled by her energy, her mission to fight anti-Semitism, and the journalistic work that she does, which is incredible. Her Substack Blacklisted is a must read. So take a listen to this special episode.
Before we keep going, because I know I want to talk to you so long. But I want to talk a little bit about your history, your experience. I had been following you for a while. And obviously this all came to a head. And so we were talking a lot late at night, but I would love for you to share a little bit about your background in your journalism, what happened in Hollywood. You can go brief. And you know, what you've been doing online to sort of combat everything you experience. And then we'll go deep into these, you know, anti-Semitism issues and what people can do to get educated so that they are aware of what's going on, even if they don't want to see burning babies or raped women.
Sure. Okay. Well, I can do a quick recap. So I always just really loved pop culture, and I loved the idea of being a writer, and wasn't very good at it at first, but you know, you write, and then eventually you find a voice for yourself. And for most of my 20s and the first half of my 30s, I was a very popular mainly music journalist, music, film, pop culture. You know, I used to run a major music magazine in London called the NME or the Musical Express. I did that for a few years, and I was responsible for breaking your favorite new artists for years. Wow. And like going on the road with them and being up close and personal with rock stars, basically. And then I decided to hot foot it over the ocean and moved to LA in 2014. I came here because one of the bands that I broke were some of my best friends, and they lived out here and invited me to come and live with them for a while. So I have this kind of like almost famous experience when I came to LA. And, you know, I started to freelance write from here. And because I was in the center of the action in Hollywood, I found myself gaining a reputation as a really good profile writer, which, you know, it wound up happening to me. Then in order to become a really, really top-notch, like, safe pair of hands, trusted profile writer, you need to be a really popular, liked, secure, honest, trustworthy journalist, that you can embed yourself with some of the world's biggest A-listers, and they, you know, they trust you enough to tell you things they've never told anyone else, and they know that you will tell their story in a way that honors them. And so I was doing that for right up until the pandemic, more or less. I was a go-to profile writer here and traveling the world, like going, again, still going on the road with people or traveling overseas to interview the biggest stars wherever they were working and on whatever projects we're doing. And I was still writing a lot about music and film and writing pieces of criticism. And I was writing for everyone. I mean, every single title on the planet I was writing for. And my career was really going places. And then the BLM movement happened, or it came completely overground, and George Floyd was killed. And that weekend, the people who were marching in the streets were vandalizing synagogues. And I said at the time on Twitter, I completely stand for fighting against anti-Black racism, systemic racism in this country. It's a problem. However, you can't fight hate with hate. And how dare you, in the name of that, vandalize Jewish places of worship? These are synagogues. They aren't Urban Outfitters. They aren't branches of Starbucks. These are holy temples for Jewish people. And as my former editor of GQ, who I used to write for all the time, I was one of their most popular profile writers, texted me, "Oh, you just did a whoopsie on Twitter." And so my whoopsie, so now you can see, you can probably read that tweet devoid of context at the moment and say, you know, fair, like that tweet's pretty innocuous, but at the time, yeah, you couldn't do anything other than post a black square and say, I'm sorry. You know, it's like, that was it.
I know. I couldn't post about my store getting vandalized because it was going to upset too many people. And I was upset because my store was vandalized, but I couldn't say anything.
Sure. Right. But and we've got to wonder how that was a healthy moment in advocacy, because people can be abused, but they can also turn into abusers. And that's what we've seen happen with all of these victim movements. And I call them victim movements because they don't really seem to be about equality and transgressing oppression. They seem to be about acquiring power and usurping power and using victimhood and weaponizing victimhood to disempower other people and take out acts of revenge that are unjustified. And like I say, it's the bullied becoming the bully, it's the abuser, the abused becoming the abuser, and that's what we experience. So after my whoopsie moment, I continued, you know, I was already advocating for Jewish people. I've been doing it since 2015 alongside my pop culture work, but it never was so front and center that it created any issues until these bigger kind of woke moments were happening. And I was so well loved and so successful that there was an element of schadenfreude to this, where I stepped out of line with the progressive community and suddenly it rained hell on earth. Mentioned, because when this was out in the world, whenever my hate name is mentioned, it just trends again for a week.
Wait, what is a hate name?
So a hate name is, I'm not going to tell you mine, but they're, you know, they're usually like pretty infantile, like toilet humor. It's the sort of thing that you would be called in a playground, where, you know, if your name, they'll rhyme your name with something really puerile and insipid. Okay. And then it would trend all the time. And it was basic, but it's not about the hate name. It's about the dehumanizing of me and the erasure of my career, because suddenly everything was about me being some kind of caricature of the evil Zionist. And my career queer was basically wiped from view overnight. I mean, sometimes I go to just to see, because it's in my gut feels that this is going to happen one day. But sometimes I go on like Pitchfork and GQ and, you know, like whatever, like LA Times, like whatever titles that I used to write for all the time. And I just like check that all of my archive is still on their websites, because I do imagine that one day they might just be like, in the trash, you know, like, yeah, because that is effectively what all of them did to my reputation. It's just overnight, you know, and it wasn't necessarily overnight. It was kind of gradual and it happened in waves, but it was once the dominoes started falling, it was unstoppable, you know.
And do you feel, as you fast forward to this moment, that you're like, see, there is anti-Semitism? And is anyone coming back to you and being like, oh, I'm sorry. Oh, just kidding. No.
No, that takes far too much accountability. No. There's been the odd person who has said to me, you know, I used to think you were really hysterical, but actually you're right. And I, you know, I shouldn't have been one of the people that thought you were hysterical. But every single one of those people was also someone who stood by me regardless of thinking I was hysterical. The people who completely shut me out, no shit for what they did, because I think it's pretty obvious now that if they did that, they would see that there's blood on their hands, and they would have to make reparations for it. Because, by the way, I'm not forgiving anyone. Like, this is unforgivable what happened. But I used to always say, you know, better safe than sorry. I would rather be hysterical and hyper vigilant and wrong than like blasé, silent and correct. And as it so happens, I was hyper vigilant and hysterical and correct. And I have no regrets at all, because, you know, for me, I'm not motivated by much other than the integrity of my work and telling the truth and disrupting narratives that are harmful and that only seek to serve the grifters and people who are, again, like trying to overpower other people. And and for that purpose, I couldn't stay working in an industry that didn't recognize my humanity. I mean, I was renowned for breaking artists of color, breaking LGBTQ plus artists, putting women on magazine covers, advocating for all of these causes. And so I couldn't stand shoulder to shoulder with people I'd been in the trenches with on all of these other issues, knowing that they could turn on a dime that fast because I'm Jewish.
So how do you, your career is ended, then you launched Blacklisted. I'm sure it wasn't, you know, there was a delay there. How have you managed to sort of come out from that and tell all the stories that you tell, and grow, you know, continue to grow your voice, continue to be out there when now it feels like things are closing in again, right? People are being silent. Hollywood is being silent. Heads of agencies are being silent. So, I mean, obviously, I feel like there's like these lights. There's these people that are just, I don't fucking care. I'm going to talk about this all the time. But I'm curious, from starting your Substack Blacklisted to now, how have you sort of carved your path in a way that you feel was how you had to rebuild?
Strategy. But it was more just do or die. I mean, it was totally about my survival. I started Blacklisted. It even says on the first post, it's called Hello. And when you sign up for a subscription, I think it automatically goes into the inbox. And I remember it was the night that Meatloaf died. And I I was sitting in my apartment listening to Meatloaf. I had like nothing left in my bank account. You know, I had like less than $1,000 left. I was extremely panicked about how I was going to continue to make rent. And I'd been doing this work for a while, and I knew that Substack was a thing that was helping journalists who'd been cancelled. And, you know, it's very hard as a Jewish advocate to get any support. It's hard to get support from our establishment organizations. Our establishment hasn't caught up to what the online activists are doing. So right. I started Substack. I started Blacklisted on Substack in an absolute blind moment of desperation and panic. I just thought, if you know, 50 people sign up tonight and sign up for $5 a month, I might be able to pay my rent this month. You know, like that was my feeling. That was why I did it. And so, and I even said at the beginning, I don't know what I'm going to write about and what this is going to be, but if you believe in me, like, just please just come along for the ride. And truly at the beginning, it was just a way for all of the thousands of people in my DMs every week to directly support my work, because I wasn't finding any other avenue for anyone to support my work. And I started to get a few speaking engagements. But again, you know, the problem with this space is that once you've kind of spoken at one WEETSO event or one AJC event or one Federation event or whatever, you've done them for a while. So it's hard to make sustainable living out of just advocating for Jewish people. And it's not about making money either. It's about being an advocate. So it's very hard to, you know, suddenly be challenged with how the hell do I survive? I've been totally blacklisted from my industry. My work is, I'm being told that my work is essential to the moment, but I don't know how to get anyone to pay for my voice or to support me. So that's why it started. And Blacklisted sort of ebbed and flowed over the course of the past. It'll be 2 years in January. So during the first year, it just sort of ebbed and flowed, and I wrote on it as when I felt compelled to. But I will also say that for a long time, because of what happened to me, I really struggled with my confidence with writing, but sometimes I just struggled to feel connected to my craft because it had brought me so much pain. And because people had so willfully like decided that I was a crappy journalist, even though I was a great journalist and still am a great journalist, because they were trying to throw the kitchen sink at ending my career. It made it quite difficult for a period to consistently write. But then I found, you know, particularly, the second October 7th began, many of my friends, including other activists who work in the space, said that they found out that Israel was under attack because I immediately posted an article about it on my Substack. And Blacklisted broke the news for many people. And then, you know, it wasn't actually October 7th here, it was October 6th, and it was about 10 o'clock at night when I saw the map of all of the air raid sirens all over Israel. And I was like, what the hell is going on? It looks like the entire country is being attacked. And then my DMs started flooding with the most horrific things I've ever seen in my life. You know, the footage of the elderly being shot at bus shelters and footage of Hamas soldiers just running around towns in southern Israel with RPGs without anyone stopping them. I mean, we'd never seen scenes like this. So I was gathering all of this information and posting it on Blacklisted. And suddenly Blacklisted turned into a Substack that could kind of do some pop culture stuff, kind of did some Jewish advocacy stuff, was sort of, you know, whatever I kind of felt like doing it in the moment. It suddenly became like war correspondence. Right. And I became like a full-fledged war reporter. And more or less every single day now since October 7th in the evening, I sit down and I do either a roundup of what's happened that day, or a broader journalistic piece to try and explain certain elements of the war to the wider world. But I've been writing on, I think I've taken about 5 days off since October 7th. And so since then, my Substack has become an essential read to, you know, I've accrued thousands upon thousands of subscribers, and I couldn't be more proud of it. It's become a best-selling Substack, and I guess you go where you're needed, right? like if someone doesn't want you at the party anymore, you leave and you go to another party. Not that this party.
You made your own party.
I made my own party. It's a scary party.
Hey, Superwomen, if you happen to be in Dallas, you can experience the Augustinus Bader brand at their first pop-up store located in the West Village, next door to Sephora. The brand will open its doors on November 16th and will be there until the end of December. So stop by for all of your critical skincare needs. They will also be offering their Epic Spa services, currently only available in New York City, in this location. So be sure to book your Bader Glow just in time for your holiday parties. As my listener, you're going to get 20% off with the code SUPERWOMEN when you shop in store, and it's valid for product purchases, not services. Go get that glow, ladies.
So I had a call with a marketing guru who I had felt was very, who's Jewish, who's very quiet. And I didn't want to attack him. And I said, you know what? I just want to know, I'm sure you're doing something, but you've been very silent. He's like, oh, I've been busy. I had a real death threat, like someone in the building to come try and kill me. So you might not see me doing it publicly, but here's what's going on in the background. And so one of the things we spoke about in our call was, we've seen the division of America in the last however many years. And you're never going to convince a Republican to become a Democrat and vice versa, right? And he said, on this issue, you're never going to sway the people that are at the polar opposites. And someone's going to say, oh, you're right. This is okay. Or it's not okay. But he said, the way to make change is to expose the hypocrisy, right? The hypocrisy of the people that are fighting for this in U.S. soil, that they would be dead if they went there, that they wouldn't be allowed to have a job, or they might be raped or hung or whatever it is. And you have to expose that, because that's the only thing that gets them to shift. So I was just curious your perspective on that, on what he said is, like, the only way we can get people to wake up is exposing just the hypocrisy of what they think they're standing up for.
Yeah, I think there's a few things there, because as I said before, it is helpful to frame this as a war between ideologies, and reminding people that if they're with the fundamentalist, you know, the fundamentalist terrorist ideology, then the country they currently live in, if the ideology was to come here, would not be remotely reflective of the present moment, and that they would be living in an autocracy. They would not be living in a democracy. So I do think that there is some use to that, to saying, you do realize that all of the fundamental rights and freedoms that you bleat on about and fight for every single day would suddenly, like, just become a truly become a moot point if this society in any way reflected the society that Hamas wants to impose with a caliphate upon the world, or rather not Hamas, but, you know, the Iranian Republic, which Hamas is just a tiny little wing of. But I think that, you know, I saw my friend Yasher Ali, who is an amazing online commentator and journalist, and who has been doing extremely fair and balanced reporting on this since October 7th and dedicated reporting, said something yesterday about how frustrating this hypocrisy argument is. And I did understand what he was saying, because what he was trying to say is it presupposes that you shouldn't fight for the rights of people in places where you wouldn't be treated as a human being. And I get that. Like, there is something problematic with that argument, because it's like saying that, you know, you shouldn't fight for women who are in autocratic African countries, because if you were a woman there, you would be treated in the same way. Like, it doesn't quite make sense. I think the thing that's more important to point out is equally recognizing Israelis and seeing them as equal, and seeing Jewish people as equal to the Palestinians that they, you know, claim to be advocating for. I think that's more the point. It's okay, fine, we hear you support the Palestinian cause, but why are you okay with what happened on October 7th? Because there were plenty of people who were murdered on that day. And similarly to the feminists, which has been the majority of, well, not the majority of my work, but a big focus of my work and my, you know, absolute horror is, okay, fine, feminists for Palestine, you're going to wear a kippah, okay, great. However, do that all you want, but there's clearly a chink in your armor here, because you seem to think that the brutal raping of women on October 7th is somehow, you know, contextualized / justified. Well, you're full of shit. You know, I think that that's more where we go.
I get that. I think that's a very salient point. And I feel like, yeah, I feel like the silence, especially around UN Women and so many women's organizations, is shocking. So where do we go from here? You know, like, as far as, like, not we the Jews, because I think we're all trying to figure out our path and ways we can amplify, but like, where do you go if you're listening to this episode today to educate yourself? Besides, they're all going to go to Blacklisted, but, and they're going to pay to subscribe, but what can people do who feel like, again, I just can't do it. It's just too much.
Look, it's very, you know, I don't know why it's more for us than it is for any other community. Like, it shouldn't be any more emotional labor unless there's something that's making you feel inherently guilty, because maybe you're guilty of having had some, you know, some bias previously towards Jews, or maybe it's the case that you don't see Jewish people as victims of atrocities in the way that you do other people. And that's something that our non-Jewish neighbors have to try and see past and accept and understand, oh, maybe I do have a problem here, generating empathy or concern for Jewish people, because I do have some kind of issue where I think that, oh, the Jews are fine. Like, they're, you know, they run things, like, they're totally fine. But that's an issue. I think the first step is to kind of face yourself and figure out why, you know, that if it was a case of, like, one child being kidnapped anywhere in the world by a bunch of monsters and being held in captivity for 50 plus days, and the whole world would stop and be on the edge of its seat. Every single award ceremony would have a segment about this child. The child would be in every single, slotted into every single series of advertisements everywhere, all over the world. You would never stop hearing about the child.
Yeah.
But we have 240 cases of this, and the world has proactively erased it, shut it out. Even now that many of them are coming out, we're still not seeing other people other than us share these heart-rending, gut-wrenching videos of these hostages being reunited with their families. It's, you know, so I think the first question is, do you feel empathy for it? If you do, great. If you don't, figure out why that is, come to terms with it, be honest with yourself. And, you know, in terms of more what you can personally do, other than obviously watch your feed, watch my feed, subscribe to my Substack, et cetera, is, first of all, seek out other advocates just like us on Instagram, who are sharing the real-time information, standing up against the propaganda, putting out factually based information, not just about the war, but also about the Jewish experience, about the history of anti-Semitism, about what it means to be Jewish. You know, there are plenty of us online, and if you follow me, you'll wind up learning who the other one. And I think, you know, there's that is both things. It's both a disaster and a really useful tool. And I think for moments like this, if you come across really great accounts that are sharing information like this, it can be an amazing educational tool. But beyond us, there are plenty of books out there that are great starters on, you know, the history of Israel, the history of this conflict. One that's really popular among people because it's such an easy read is Noah Tishby's book. It's just called Israel, I think. I think it's called Israel, the most, I can't remember the long title, but it's Israel by Noah Tishby. You'll find it.
Yeah, okay.
You know, I also thought that a few years ago, I read Barry Weiss's How to Fight Anti-Semitism. That's a really also easy read, very quick introduction on where anti-Semitism comes from and why it shows up differently on the left and on the right and also in the Arab world. Yeah, there's so many books. I mean, I could list many books that are very useful. Letters to My Palestinian Neighbor is an incredible book by Yossi Klein Halevi, who's an academic who lives in Tel Aviv. I think he lives in Tel Aviv. And it's a beautiful book for not, I think it particularly has been popular with non-Jewish people I've shared it with as a very balanced understanding of what it's like for Israelis and Palestinians to live next to each other and sometimes to coexist living peacefully within these texts and engage with them.
You're a wealth of information and I appreciate that. And I think that people starting by following you and, you know, subscribing to Blacklisted will get a good start. I feel like I could talk to you for 5 more hours and I know you have to go. Is there anything that we didn't touch on that you think is important to underline?
I think it's just really important to understand how fragile a time this is for the Jewish community, how emotionally complex it is for us. And by that, I mean that there's an emotional roller coaster that we're on all the time right now. And it can be very isolating and it can mean that we can feel quite dissociated from everything else that's going on in the world. I think Thanksgiving for me was a very clear example of that, where, you know, I struggled to feel connected to what was in the calendar of the rest of the world while this is going on, because as we see so often, when there are seismic shifts and halts in society, when really drastic, terrible things happen and everyone recognizes the moment and comes together, and we're currently going through a moment where that's not happening for us. Right. So we're having to hold our pain separately in an individual community, separate from the rest of the world. And honestly, Jews are used to doing that. It's kind of the Jewish way. But I think
we expect it different.
Yeah. Check in with us.
Yeah.
Be a bit kinder. We don't need tough love and debates about geopolitics and, you know, fights. We need comfort and understanding and an ear. We need people to listen. Yeah. And we also need you to ask the awkward questions that you've never asked. Just ask them and we will answer them and then accept the answer.
Right.
Like, don't fight the answer. Just accept it because we're telling you the truth.
Right. 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 There's no buts in this case. This is not a time for buts.
Zero. No.
I still remain so thankful and grateful for everything you're doing, your voice, your outspokenness, your bravery, frankly, because I know it must not be easy. So thank you. Have a good
thank
Shabbat.
You. You too. Shabbat Shalom. Thank you so much for having me and for supporting everything that I do and for being a brave voice yourself.
Of course. I just wanted to thank you guys
for listening to today's episode. I also want to ask you to rate and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts. I know it's a pain in the butt, but it actually helps with search and algorithms. So if you love this podcast, it is an easy way to get it more visible and out there. I also want you to follow me on Instagram at Rebecca Minkoff, at RM Superwomen, and be sure to check out my book, Fearless, The New Rules for Unlocking Creativity, Courage, and Success. Thank you again, and you will hear from me next week.